Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, welcome to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Today I'm joined by Teresa, Nicola, Linda, Heather, and Steph.
Hello.
Hi.
This week on Write Club, we're going to be talking about the Booker Prize and the lesser known, not the Booker. But before that, Teresa is going to be reading from her work in progress. Linda will be sharing her thoughts on rejection. And then Steph and Sam Blake will be telling us what's on their bedside tables. But first of all, Heather's going to ask us to
name the novel.
This book was written in 1927. It's a series of poems set in a fictional wood identical to Ashdown Forest in East Sussex. And it's particularly relevant to Write Club.
Really? A series of poems.
Okay.
The author was born on the 18th of January 1882 and served in both World Wars. He was injured in the Battle of the Somme. He wrote propaganda for MI7 and he was the assistant editor of Punch magazine. He played cricket with J.M. Barrie and Arthur Conan Doyle.
Okay.
His first novel was The Red House Mystery, and when asked to write another, he is quoted as saying, "The only excuse I have yet discovered for writing anything is that I want to write it. I should be as proud to be delivered of a telephone directory as I should be ashamed to create a blank verse tragedy at the bidding of others."
Red House Mystery sounds familiar, but I can't think.
I'm thinking A.A. Milne.
Well, I was.
Yeah. Is it the Thousand Acre Wood or?
Nope.
No.
Well, that would be Winnie the Pooh.
Winnie the Pooh is A.A. Milne.
Well, poems would be like.
Now we are six.
Okay. Very good.
I got that the wrong way round.
Yeah. Okay. But that's how well it's connected. Right Club, we are six.
Now we are six.
Yes, right. Yeah. Okay, very good. Well done.
Excellent.
That's a good one. That Heather's thinking.
Yes. Thank you, Heather. Okay, now we're going to hear from Teresa. And I never know what to expect from you. Is it going to be the novel? Is it going to be an extract from the play? Is it a travel piece?
It's a travel piece.
Okay.
Okay, so this is based on an afternoon or a short incident in my recent holiday in Crete, and it's called Floria. At the highest point on the mountain road from Hania to Kandinos, we enter Floria, martyred village. There's a fire engine in the small parking area beside the caffineo. We read the list of Greek names on the marble slab that commemorates the day in 1941 when the locals spontaneously resisted the German invading force. Like many villages in Crete, it was razed in retribution. Across the road is the later German conciliatory monument. While mourning the dead, we seek friendship with the living. According to our guidebook, there's a church in the upper village with frescoes by a noted 15th century artist. The lower village consists of two roadside coffee shops and a few scattered houses. At least it is a little cooler up here in the mountains. An insignificant sign indicates the route to the church. The road is tarmac at first, with trees looming over. After a few minutes, we see a little goat's leg lying in the road. Not decayed or fly-blown, just the lower limb of a kid, intact, with coarse hair and cloven hoof. Looking up, we see a huge bird circling high above us. The road turns to dirt as we zigzag upwards. The pines smell like retsina. No sign of a church. We see a group of buildings just off the track, but the path is a dead end, so we carry on up. One zig, one zag, and we really are at the end of the road. A house with two or three vehicles parked outside. Some hunting dogs in a wire enclosure snap and snarl aggressively at us. Their chains jangle as they throw themselves at the fence. No church. No village. We shout, Yasu, but no one comes. We go down, one zag, one zig, to the first group of houses we passed, and now there is a boy playing football in the track that divides them. We ask for directions to the church. He calls his mother. She says, "My Nikos will show you." The boy heads back down the way we came up. We follow his number 11 shirt. Nearly back where we started, he points to a track through an olive grove. "Follow the path to the church," he says, and heads for home. We call him back to give him something for an ice cream. It's cool in the olive grove. The trees look ancient, their thick trunks like knotted ropes. Soon we spot the white marble monuments of the graveyard. The church is open, but the frescoes are black with mould. Someone has decorated the place with garlands of plastic flowers. Later, over a cold drink, we read about the rare lammergeier, or bearded vulture, that drops bones from a height to extract the marrow. But there are only about 25 left in Crete. Could we really have been that lucky?
I just love the juxtaposition of the old and the new in this. I love, you know, the number 11 shirt, the plastic flowers and in the ancient church. The dogs, I just think you just capture how mixed up it is here and how lovely that is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know more about the goat leg. How did a little goat leg that's fresh, obviously, where's the rest of him, and how did that get there?
What's the vulture?
Well, that's the vulture. I can only assume that the bird circling overhead had dropped it because they dropped them to smash the bones to extract the marrow.
I know, but where's the rest of him?
I don't know.
Surely the vulture didn't get all of that. You can't carry a whole lamb. A goat.
No. They're big. They're huge.
Yeah.
They're huge.
I've seen eagles. Videos of eagles picking up babies in coats. You know, they can live quite a weight.
Yeah.
They dropped it again.
In any case, I don't know where the rest of it is. Mm-hmm. It's what I saw.
Yeah, it's quite an image. It's just quite an image.
Yeah, it was really bizarre to see it, and as a completely fresh and, you know, anyway.
Yeah.
I really, really loved that present tense.
Yeah.
I really felt the immediacy of being there. Mm. Really, really liked that.
Right. I thought it was very good and very descriptive. I liked the description all the way through.
Did you notice I put a smell in?
Yes, I smell.
And the other thing I noticed and really enjoyed about this was the short sentences. You know that, and I remember you doing that with your in the footsteps of Jules Verne as well.
Right.
The alternating between the longer sentences and the short observational sentences. I really feel that puts you right there, doesn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It made me want to go.
Yes.
Which I think is what good travel writing is about. Mm.
Yeah. Well, I love Crete. It's the second time I've been to Crete, and I would recommend it. There's so much of it. I have only seen a fragment of it. I know you've been as well, haven't you?
Yes, but it's I missed so many of the recommended sites.
Yeah. Yeah.
I went some years ago and got to go there for months on end.
Yeah, there is a lot to see.
But this holiday was driven quite literally by my daughter. You know, it was what she wanted to do, and we did. Yeah. And she's interested, you know, in these in the war years and what happened in Crete. So, we went to those places.
I didn't know whether there should be, and I don't know whether this is to do with it being a travel piece as opposed to as a piece of fiction.
Yeah.
And I didn't know whether there needed to be a little bit more on that last section that was the kind of the disappointment of the frescoes that were now black with mould. And the kind of excitement at the possibility that you'd seen one of these remaining 25. I don't know what anyone else thinks.
I mean, can you suggest how that could be done?
It would have to introduce feelings. As a travel piece, you haven't done particularly, have you?
No, I haven't.
You're there, obviously. Mm. You're aware of it.
I think for me, it evoked those feelings for me rather than being told how Teresa felt. I felt the disappointment. I didn't feel that I needed to be told how Teresa felt.
Mm. Well, you know that often in Greece something is bigged up, you know, like there's this ancient fountain somewhere, and you go up the mountain and there's a hose pipe coming out of a rock, you know, and it's just like the ancient fountain of the nymphs or something. Yeah. But it's not. It is what it is, you know.
We went to Arreca last year.
the guy at the hotel said, you must go up this mountain, you must go, this cave is magnificent. And so, you know, we got all the way up there, and you know, we come from Derbyshire, so we've got a lot of caves in Derbyshire.
Yeah, John Mines and all
that's
of that.
That's right, and there was this like, kind of little room. It was about this big, you know, and very plain. We've just come all this way.
Yeah.
It wasn't worth looking at all.
I had a similar experience in Spain, if you've ever been to the Roman spa. I'm putting my fingers up and doing inverted commas, just outside Marbella and Puerto Banús. And, it, you know, again, heard about it for ages and went finally. And actually, it was a scruffy little hole in the ground. People were queuing to get in and out. But then it was actually more charming because it was less commercial than I expected.
Right, yeah.
And you did go into this underground sort of cave spa thing. And then you came out and just caked yourself with mud, which you scraped off a mud bank. You know, it was very uncommercial and it was more, all the more lovely for them. But bigged up, yes. Yeah.
But back to what Pat was saying, I did feel that it ended abruptly, rather abruptly. Yeah. And so perhaps, I don't know what you'd like to do.
Yeah, I totally agree. It was just like how to end it. And also ending with a question, is that a bit weak as well?
I don't think so. But I just
needed something. Yeah, it needs a bit more at the end. Yeah,
right.
I agree. I'd take that on board. I'd say it needs something.
Okay, so thank you, everyone. Linda, apparently you've been feeling rejected lately. Please share with us.
I haven't submitted because it's taking me so long to write. I was thinking about rejection slips and letters, and so I thought that I would do this little amuse-bouche with some funny and surprising rejections that some famous writers have received. But first, I went to this site called, I think it's Literary Hub, and there was this wonderful essay, Why You Should Strive Not for Acceptance, But for Rejection, a lot, 100 a year at least. And the reason is because if you're trying to collect them, there's sort of this wonderful, okay, good, I got another
positivity.
Rather than, and by submitting that much, then you get acceptances
you increase
as well.
Your chances.
Yes. Mm. And so
it's a numbers game, as we say in sales.
It is, and I just thought that was a wonderful way to look at it. I'd never thought of it before. Now on to some of the people who've been rejected. Some of these, well, actually, these days we don't get so much comment on them. We get either a form or nothing, which is not good. But back in the day, I guess they made comments a lot. So Emily Dickinson received one that said, your poems are quite as remarkable for defects as for beauties and are generally devoid of true poetical qualities.
That's harsh.
And The Wizard of Oz, Frank Baum, received too radical of a departure from traditional juvenile literature. Some of these are just so funny. William Faulkner's Sanctuary was rejected with, good God, I can't publish this. Rudyard Kipling, after he'd submitted a short story, received this one. I'm sorry, Mr. Kipling, but you just don't know how to use the English language.
Whoa, after he'd written that fantastic poem as well.
Lady Chatterley's Lover, D.H. Lawrence, for your own sake, do not publish this book.
And for everybody else's, you had to endure it.
That's right. Herman Melville's masterpiece, Moby Dick, received a really, I thought this was so funny. It was turned down by multiple publishers. And then he received this letter from Peter J. Bentley, Bentley & Son Publishing House. It says, first we must ask, does it have to be a whale?
What else is it
going to
be?
Well, he says, while this is a rather delightful, if somewhat esoteric, plot device, we recommend an antagonist with a more popular visage among the younger readers. For instance, could not the captain be struggling with a depravity toward young, perhaps voluptuous maidens?
It's strange.
Get rid of the whale. Let's get some
voluptuous.
Yeah.
Well, it's sublimated in Moby Dick, isn't it?
It's suppose. And Gertrude Stein, we're all familiar with her. What is it? Postmodernist, I guess. It was ridiculous, I thought. But, you know, her famous quotes are, a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose. And then, there is no there, there, she's saying things. So she spent 22 years submitting before getting a single poem accepted. Oh, can you imagine?
22 years.
That's yeah, and how dare we, you know, get discouraged after a year? Well, hopefully we don't write like that. But she received this rejection from says the British publishing house A.C. Fifield. After receiving one of her manuscripts, the founder of that wrote, I am only one, only one, only one. And he goes on, only one being, only one, having only one pair of eyes, having only one time, having only one life. I cannot read your manuscript three or four times, not even one time. Only one look is enough.
That's brilliant. That is so brilliant.
I like that.
Yeah, and T.S. Eliot was working at Faber and Faber. Well, I guess they're a very good and old and respected publishing house. Mm-hmm. Stephanie's finished a course there. And he wrote a largely apologetic rejection of Animal Farm to George Orwell. And he says in part, we have no conviction, and I am sure none of our other directors would have, that this is the right point of view from which to criticize the political situation at the present time. Your pigs are far more intelligent than the other animals, and therefore the best qualified to run the farm. In fact, there couldn't have been an animal farm at all without them, so that what is needed, someone might argue, was not more communism, but more public-spirited pigs.
At least you know they've read it if they come back with something like that.
That's exactly the point I was going to make. You were saying we don't get proper rejection letters because they'd have to read it to actually make it. So nowadays you're going to get an automatic email response or something like that.
And Marcel Proust, have any of you read Remembrance of Things Past? Oh, Teresa.
Teresa's
read it.
We should know. 1.5 million.
In English, not in French.
Okay, 1.5 million words long. And his rejection says, I rack my brains why a chap should need 30 pages to describe how he turns over in bed before going to sleep. And Agatha Christie, 5 years of continual rejection. Finally, she got a publishing deal. And her book sales are now, of course, in excess of 2 billion. Only William Shakespeare has sold more. Mm-hmm. Isn't that amazing that, you know, it's people can be
and
so...
And he didn't publish a single book in his lifetime.
Agatha Christie? William Shakespeare. Oh, pity me, pity me. 25 literary agents rejected The Time Traveler's Wife. And you imagine that?
That gives you hope, doesn't it?
That's one of the reasons that I like that book so much. Mm. You think, you know, she believed in it and she just kept going.
You have to keep going. I mean, imagine going for a couple of years. And
how much money she'd have made if she'd self-published.
Yeah. But continuing to submit over and over because you believe in the book. Mm. It's wonderful. And The Help by Catherine Sockett was rejected 60 times.
Wow. 60 Harry Potter times. Was rejected, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Anti-Mame. Patrick Dennis wrote it. He, despite 17 rejections, and he became the first author in history to have 3 books ranked on the New York Times bestseller list at the same time. He had worked through publishers in alphabetical order. The one that finally agreed to take him was Vanguard Press.
Well, start at the other end of the alphabet.
We'll start from the middle and work out.
The estate of bestseller Jack London in San Francisco has a collection of some of the 600 rejections he received before
600
before selling a single story. Yeah.
Okay, there we go. So that's our new target. 600
rejections. Right. I was aiming for 100 in a year.
And I love this. To prove how hard it is for new writers to break in, Jerzy Kosinski used a pen name to submit his bestseller Steps to 13 literary agents and 14 publishers. All of them rejected, including Random House, who had published it. So I love that he did that. I just think that's wonderful and so encouraging, isn't it, for the rest of us?
You say it's encouraging. In some ways it is, but in other ways it's very depressing to think that you're not even going to get a read.
It's a lottery.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Well, as Stephanie has said many, many times, and, you know, you have to get your email right, you have to get your synopsis. If you get your email or letter wrong, they're not even going to look at the synopsis.
That's right.
If they look at your synopsis and that's not done right...
Well, they tend to... Most of the ones I've heard speak, the literary agents say, they look at the email and they make a decision whether or not to open the document that's got the words in it. Then they read the first 10,000 words or whatever.
That's it.
And the minute they come across an adverb or a comma in the wrong place or something like that, it's a good excuse. They said... They're looking for reasons to reject.
Mm. Well, I have
because
something.
They've got such a huge pile to read.
And I found something here from a literary agent who wrote about why and how it's so hard. And he says that one of the more challenging aspects of being a literary agent is dealing with the incredible deluge of submissions that pour in every single day, 24 hours a day, from all corners of the globe, for every type of project imaginable. He said, I don't keep precise stats on the number I receive. It's hard enough just to answer them all. But in any given year, I receive somewhere between 15,000 and 20,000 query letters from aspiring authors. Out of those tens of thousands, I reject all but a tiny handful of them and take on perhaps 3 to 5 clients a year whose work I then shop to publishers. Mm-hmm. So from getting 15 to 20,000 queries, he'll take 3 to 5. And he says, contrary to the myth that an agent is sitting at a desk cackling as they read the submissions from the supposedly untalented masses, I loathe sending rejection letters. Mm-hmm. Loathe, loathe, loathe. He says, not because it's tedious, but because honestly, who am I to be telling someone they're not worthy of publication?
Yeah. Yeah.
As I search for the diamonds every day, I have to pass on the life's work of cancer survivors, abuse victims, war heroes, and many more people who spent hours upon hours of their life writing a novel in the faint hope that it would someday find publication. I don't enjoy sending these rejection letters, and I never forget that on the other end of the letter there's a person out there whose day I'm probably ruining and whose dreams I'm chipping away at. I just thought that was a wonderful thing to hear from an editor, and that was Nathan Bransford, and this was published in the Huffington Post. I was glad to hear, well, at least he is looking at it and thinking about the person who, read it. And back to J.K. Rowling, it says here that Christopher Little, literary agent, receives 12 publishing rejections in a row for their new client, J.K. Rowling, until the 8-year-old daughter of a Bloomsbury editor demands to read the rest of the book, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. The editor then agrees to publish, but advised Rowling to get a day job since she has little chance of making money in children's books.
I love the fact that it was given to a child and it was the child who said, actually, I want to read this.
So isn't that one?
And it's quite young to be reading Philosopher's Stone, isn't it?
Without
a parent reading it to them.
But, you know, she received many more rejections before that. This is after she got a literary agent. and
that's only the first step.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
And the literary agents are looking for the next big thing. They're looking for talent.
Yes, they do
want talent,
a good manuscript,
but they do have to get through an awful lot, and you can't blame them for saying, you know, if I've seen some problems in the email,
mm-hmm.
I'm not even going to go on because
that some very good books are going to slip through the cracks,
right?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And not see the light of day,
as we've seen here, you know, with William Faulkner and J.K. Rowling and all of these people, and some of them being rejected very harshly.
I love
the suggestion that we don't use a whale in Melville.
Oh, sometimes they just miss the point, don't they? That's great that somebody completely misses the point.
I think maybe on our Facebook group it would be good to hear about some rejections that
listeners
have had.
I would love to hear that. Please send to us. And it's not a matter anymore of feeling really rejected or shameful or whatever. Now we're striving to collect those rejection letters.
600 of them.
Yeah. The company of giants.
Yes, that's it.
Okay, well, thank you, everyone, for that. Now, it's a big week in the literary world with the announcement of this year's Man Booker Prize. And so we thought it might be a good idea to talk about some of the nominations and the prize winners over the years.
Yeah, I've been looking at the history of the Man Booker Prize, which is 50 years old this year. So it started in 68 when Booker McConnell Limited, who were a firm dealing in sugar, rum, mining machinery, etc., announced a £5,000 prize for fiction, and this was to be awarded to a British or Commonwealth author. But since 2014, it's been open to anyone writing in English and published in the UK. Now, I was speaking to a writer the other day who felt this was a bit of a shame, and it's become dominated by US writers, and she made the point, you know, we can't enter for the Pulitzer. However, and this was a platform for Commonwealth writers, so that's a little bit of controversy there.
Controversy.
In 1993, soldiering on, in the face of hecklers, Salman Rushdie won the Booker of Bookers for the best winner of the first 25 years, and that was Midnight's Children.
Mm.
And this year, Michael Ondaatje has been awarded the Golden Booker for The English Patient, because it's the 50th anniversary year. Seems to me sometimes the shortlisted books have more staying power, more impact than the winners. The Handmaid's Tale, for example, Empire of the Sun, these are books which didn't win but were shortlisted. There's been plenty of controversy in the history of the Booker.
What would you say then, Linda?
Controversy.
Right, okay.
It's controversial. Controversy.
Okay, carry on. In November 1972, winning author John Berger protested against Booker McConnell's working practices in the Caribbean by donating half of his £5,000 prize to the British Black Panther movement. In 1980, there was a bit of a spat between William Golding and Anthony Burgess. Golding was nominated for Rites of Passage and Burgess for Earthly Powers. Burgess refused to attend the ceremony unless he could be guaranteed a win. So he didn't attend and Golding won. In 1981, nominee John Banville wrote a letter to The Guardian requesting that the prize be given to him so that he could buy every copy of the long-listed books in Ireland and donate them to libraries, thus ensuring that the books not only are bought, but also read. He didn't win in 81. He had to wait until 2005 when he won with The Sea. But again, this was
synonym for controversy.
This was controversial. He beat Kazuo Ishiguro by 3-2, but many people thought it was a wrong decision. Life of Pi, Jan Martel's 2001 bestseller, was considered the fourth favourite for that year's Booker. That is until a page on the Booker Prize website announced it as the winner a week before the decision. Life of Pi immediately became the odds-on favourite to win, with more bets placed on it than any other Booker nominee ever. Unfortunately for the bookies, the leak proved correct and Martel won the award unanimously. In 1983, the judges were split down the middle, but the jury chair, Faye Weldon, still had a vote. So the two ballots cast for J.M. Curtsey's Life and Times of Michael Kay and two for Salman Rushdie's Shame. With only minutes before the scheduled announcement, Weldon cast her vote for Rushdie, only to switch to curtsy as a winner was being announced. Let's stop, I've changed my mind. The other one.
Wow.
In 2001, Scottish writer A.L. Kennedy had some harsh words about the prize, calling it a pile of crooked nonsense. Kennedy, who'd been on the jury for the 1996 award, dismissed the selection process as corrupt, saying the winner was determined by who knows who, who's sleeping with who, who's selling drugs to who, who's married to who, whose turn it is. Of her fellow judges on the committee who awarded the prize to Graham Swift for his novel Last Orders, she said, I read the 300 novels and no other bastard did. In 1993, two judges threatened to quit the committee after Irving Welsh's novel Trainspotting was named to the long list. You know, obviously, it's got a lot of swearing and also very strong sort of Edinburgh vernacular. The two judges said their feminist sensibilities were offended, and the book was pulled from the shortlist.
Oh,
I mean, how can you put something on a shortlist and then say, oh, take it off? Welsh has made no secret of his disdain for the prize, calling it highly imperialist-orientated, and saying that any claim that it's an inclusive, non-discriminatory award could be demolished by anybody with even a rudimentary grasp of sixth form sociology. Mm-hmm. And James Kelman became the only Scotsman ever to win the Booker in 1994 for his Stream of Consciousness novel, How Late It Was, How Late. The decision was not without controversy. However, Rabbi Julia Neuberger, a judge on the panel, threatened to resign from the panel if it win. It did, and she declared the decision crap.
Oh,
so any favourite Booker winner or Booker shortlisted books here?
I liked Paddy Clarke, Ha Ha Ha, mm-hmm. Robert mm-hmm. Doyle.
Mm-hmm.
And I also liked the Regeneration trilogy, but it was only book three that won.
Like Pat Barker?
Pat Barker, mm-hmm. yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what was the name of that one?
The Ghost Road.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Does anybody actually set out to read the Booker Prize winners or the shortlist? No. Or do you,
I know people who do, and I know like certain companies like the book people will put together the package, the shortlisted books, £30 for all six or something like that, and people do read them. And
it's a way to go for me, perhaps for people, you know, like I want to read more good books, and it's a way of starting, isn't it?
Well, I went to Goodreads and looked at the top listed books according to Goodreads, and number one was Life of Pi by Jan Martel. Mm. Number two, The God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy. And number three, The Remains of the Day by Kazu Ishiguro. Ishiguro. I've read all three of those, so they're obviously commercially successful as well as things. Hilary Mantel with Wolf Hall, she's number 10. Now, that was quite a departure because that was a historical novel.
Which yeah, and she's won it twice.
Yeah, she has.
Mm. And that was a... Is she the only person to have won it twice? Or?
I don't know if she's the only
person. She was the first person to
win it twice. I'm not sure.
Not sure.
Salman Rushdie, she's been nominated a lot of times.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Schindler's List, that was at number 13 in the chart. I just picked out the ones I knew. Mm-hmm. Paddy Clarke, as I've mentioned, and the Regeneration trilogy. And then, of course, Hotel de Lac by Anita Bruckner.
Which I didn't even realise was a booker.
Yeah, but I think I read that after it had become a film or a television series or something. Yeah. You know? So so I probably do read prize-winning books because they've got more exposure.
Yeah,
so in that respect,
you're aware of them. Yeah,
in that respect, winning the prize obviously works. They get more exposure, therefore you discuss them more and hear about them. But I've never actually set out to read them. But looking at not the Booker, I thought maybe next year I will get involved and read all the Booker shortlist.
Well, I'm currently reading The Moor's Last Sigh by Salman Rushdie, which was nominated but didn't win. But I'm absolutely loving it. It's a really colourful cast of characters, a lot of humour, it's a big kind of complicated family saga about this Indian, Portuguese, Moorish, Jewish complicated family, and it's really brilliant. I'm enjoying that, and I do love the 2014 winner, The Narrow Road to the Deep North. Absolutely adore that book. And
is that
want
on
to
that
read again.
Myanmar?
Yes, it is. The Burma Railway, as it was called. Yeah, and I would recommend that to anyone. It's deeply moving, powerful, brilliant, brilliant book.
Anybody ever aware of ever having disagreed massively with any of the prize winners or shortlists?
Well, I read Snowdrops, which was shortlisted, and I thought it was extremely thin on all sorts of levels. Mm. I mean, it described snow beautifully.
Yeah.
in about 27 different ways, but that was Miller, wasn't it?
Did it say how it smells?
That's what was missing.
Voiced by my own petard. I can see that it has some literary merit, but I thought the plot was thin. I thought the characters were a bit caricatured, a bit unbelievable. It was a thoroughly depressing read.
Well,
I was not shocked. Much of a story.
No.
I was shocked how few of them I'd actually read, winners or otherwise. But I did find The Remains of the Day, Hotel Du Lac, Black Dogs, Ian McEwan, which I've read. I tend to find an author and then read everything by that author.
Yes.
And I was pleasantly surprised to find The Comfort of Strangers by Ian McEwan, which I haven't read, so I'm looking forward to reading that now. But there was one that jumped out at me as I was skimming recently years' list, was The Bone People by Kerry Hume, a New Zealand writer. And apparently it's very, very unusually written and very powerful, and I think I might read that.
That sounds interesting, doesn't it? So that's a book that...
Yeah, it's all based around three characters who interact, but there's lots of Maori folklore woven in there as well.
And how is it unusually written?
Just the description I read sounds like it's not a straight narrative. It was very high. You know, obviously it sounded intriguing enough to jump off the page at me as I was just skimming the titles and the short descriptions. So I found two new books by doing this.
Because I know you're always stuck for something to read.
Absolutely.
I think it would be a good idea to read them next year.
I think so too.
Ooh,
we could do that as a Write Club project.
I'm reading one, I've just finished reading one of this year's nominations called Normal People. Mm. It's quite funny, following on from reading Sam Blake, because it's set in Ireland and Irish author, who, Julie Myerson in The Guardian, said, "I was reminded of Jane Austen. Think Pride and Prejudice with hangovers and finals."
That sounds good.
Which kind of intrigued me.
Yes, yeah.
And I like it. I'll be interested to see what happens to that one.
Right.
Normal People. It's by Sally Rooney.
That's a nice example of having a handle for your book, isn't it? Yes. Like a one-word strapline.
What was it? Call the Midwife with Straight Jackets.
That's how Lacking Grace was described by the
Midwife. That's quite... Going back to what Nicola just said about...
The Bone People.
People. This was slightly oddly written. There's an awful lot of dialogue. Because there's so much of it, she dispenses with inverted commas and so on. I wasn't sure at first. I thought, am I going to like this? It started off when the two protagonists are school age, and then it only progresses really into sort of university age. And I thought, is it going to be too, I don't know what the right word is.
Alternative.
Not necessarily alternative, but just...
Not of interest to
you. Not of interest to me at this stage. But I did get hooked into it.
And was there any police procedure in it at all?
Do you know, there's not a single crime there. Well, no, but there isn't a single crime or an anatomy of...
No detectives?
Detectives.
Yeah. Well, there you go. It kept your interest despite those laps.
So it was good. That has to be a good thing. Steph, you mentioned earlier Not the Booker as well, which I'd never heard of till very recently.
The Guardian started this about 10 years ago, Not the Booker Prize. Because of the Booker being considered elitist and, you know, being so controversial, they established a different prize, Not the Booker. And instead of £50,000, which is what the Booker Prize is worth now, the winner gets a mug, which I think is nice. It's billed as the world's most democratic literary prize. Books are nominated by members of the public and largely voted for by them. So once the long list is published... And you can go on the Guardian website and find it. Then you're invited to write reviews. A shortlist is selected then according to the reviews that have been written by members of the public. And then a panel is chosen from the most dedicated reviewers. So if you do a lot of reviews and good reviews, then they'll invite you to be a judge. And they, along with the voting public, choose the winner. So that's interesting. So we should probably look at that next year as well. Mm. We've got an interview in a moment with Naomi Kruger, who was nominated this year for her debut novel. May was nominated for Not the Booker. You only need one fan to nominate you. So that's, it does make it really open. Really.
One fan to nominate?
Yeah, one person to nominate.
Well, my goodness, then the list must be a mile long.
I imagine it's quite a big, big list in the initial stages.
Perhaps we should dedicate ourselves to read the short list.
not the long list, anyway. Yeah. So are we going to the interview now?
Yes.
Let's do that.
Let's do that.
I'm delighted to be joined by Naomi Kruger today. Naomi Kruger is a writer and creative writing lecturer based in Northwest England. She's previously published short stories and creative non-fiction. Her first novel was published by Seren in March this year. Hi, Naomi.
Hello.
Hi. So tell me, Naomi, what inspired you to write May?
I got the opportunity to go and visit an old family friend who I'd known through a church community who had just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And my dad was going to visit her. I'd known her since I was a child, and she'd always been that kind of like an auntie figure in my life, really interested in my progress. And I almost didn't go because just hearing, this was a few years ago now, but just hearing that word Alzheimer's, it brought all the most dark, negative, you know, images and stereotypes that you associate with dementia. I was really scared of her not recognizing me. I was scared that I would say the wrong thing and make things worse and how she would be. I did go, and she was in the early stages of Alzheimer's, and you could tell that, you know, she was forgetting things in the short term, like what she'd had for lunch, etc. But she was herself, you know, she was funny and really forthright. She was making jokes. She was asking me questions about my childhood, about things that had happened when I was young that I'd forgotten. And about my health as well, because I'd had meningitis as a child and I'd also had chronic fatigue syndrome. And so she was like, how are you doing? How are you feeling? So what I'd imagined the conversation to be like was sort of reversed, you know, that structure. I thought I was going to go in there and be the lucid one. And it wasn't at all. And I think it just really made me think about my own fear, my own, the flaws of my memory. And in my mind, there was going to be this huge distance between us, but there wasn't. So it really got me thinking about the way that dementia is represented, the way and how powerful that fear can be if you only think about the end stages and the most dark and terrible effects of dementia, which obviously are real, and how that can affect people and mean that they don't communicate and connect and what that means. And so I wanted to write about that somehow. The book actually isn't based, it's not autobiographical, and none of the characters are based around that incident or around the friend that I spoke to. But what I did want to explore in the book was the importance of connection, even when it's difficult, and also to think about memory and how, even though, of course, dementia does affect memory and affects perception and does change people, I wanted to kind of draw attention to the fact that we're all flawed. We all lie about things, consciously or not. We all misremember. And we're not as far away from each other as we think we are. So I went into writing the book with those kind of ideas in mind. But of course, writing it was very, very complex, and it changed, you know, along the process, along the way.
It's interesting you say that the word Alzheimer's has all these dark connotations. And I hope you don't mind me saying, but I sort of dreaded reading the book. I don't know a book about Alzheimer's, it's going to be grim, but of course it's not. It's peopled with all these wonderful, colourful, believable characters, and you know, the idea of reaching out, which I think is most well expressed through the carer Afsana, who continues to see May as an individual and to try to engage with her. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
How did you go about researching the condition?
Well, the first thing I did was start writing, really. I think as a writer, sometimes you just want to plunge into something and see what happens. And so I began writing just using my own imagination, really. And I was doing a PhD at the time at Lancaster University, and we would put drafts onto online forums, and then anyone in our group could comment and give feedback. Mm-hmm. And so I put a really early draft of a chapter written from May's perspective onto this forum, and somebody who wasn't in my group, so wasn't really meant to comment on my work, came straight in. They came in with a comment saying, you know, my mother-in-law has Alzheimer's, and this is just completely unbelievable. You know, the way that you've written this, she's too coherent. It's not right. It's not a really believable kind of representation. And I was a little bit stung because, you know, I just thought, okay, wow, you know, But what it made me realise was this is not just about me telling a story. This is something that affects people's lives. And if I get this wrong, I mean, not that there's only one way to experience dementia. Everyone with dementia has a different experience, but there are things that I need to do research into and kind of get right. And so I started reading books, not kind of hard science, but books that talked about the science of dementia, the symptoms of dementia, the way that people, you know, the way it develops. And then I also volunteered for 6 months in a dementia day centre because I wanted to actually speak to people with dementia, be around them, see what it's like in that environment if I'm going to write about it, but also to see the different ways that people with dementia interact and at different stages and with different kinds of forms of dementia. I didn't expect to be doing that when I started it. I thought I'm just going to write a story and I'm going to use my imagination. But I really did feel that there was a real ethical demand for me to be more informed and to try and think through what I was doing and what the effects of this representation might be for people who have cared for someone who have lived with this disease.
Mm-hmm. You use multiple voices and the narrative moves backwards and forwards in time. Was it difficult to keep track of everything?
Yes, it was. And I'm not a planner. I don't sit down and plan a novel out before I start. I'm trying to do that with my second, actually, to see if it'll work. But I tend to just dive in. So in some ways, it was a bit of a nightmare. I kept a rolling sort of a Word document where I would have all the kind of major timelines of the characters, when they were born, you know, how their lives intersected, and also the dates and times for each of the chapters. Because although May's section of the book takes place on one day, the other characters' chapters move around in time quite a lot. So I kept track of it. But what I did, because the chapters are quite separate in some ways, I was able to focus on them one at a time and really immerse myself in that moment. So that meant it was quite manageable to write. But it also meant that the editing process was really, really complex. Because when I look back at what I had in the various drafts, the editing came about getting the right balance. You know, what order should this be experienced in and whose voices should we hear first, and how much connection do I want to put into the different stories? Because I did want the structure of the book to in some way echo this disruption of dementia, and that the way that dementia means that you can't piece together a narrative anymore easily. Yeah, right. You can't necessarily access things in order anymore, or, you know, piece things together. So I wanted to echo that, but I also wanted the book to be readable and accessible and not be off-putting, you know, for readers, and to emphasise the need for connection and the need to, and the way that our identities are all formed by other people. We rely on our families and communities. We're not just individuals. So there was this balance going on all the way between disruption and connection. And in the editing process, that's when I really tried to get that right.
So how did it come about that you were nominated for the Not the Booker Prize?
Yeah, this was really interesting because with the Not the Booker, because it's sort of an alternative prize to, in some ways, counter some of the elitism of some of the bigger prizes that are decided by panels of, you know, prestigious judges. To get nominated for the long list, all you really need is an enthusiastic reader. Oh. So someone who's willing to champion your book. So I was really lucky in that I had a reader who was willing to nominate me. And so all they had to do was to read kind of the terms and conditions. And you have to write a comment on the Guardian page where you're willing to nominate the book that's obviously within the publishing kind of window for the award, and give a brief review and why you like it. So I had a reader who did that, which was really lovely. And you only need one, actually, but obviously sometimes people have multiple nominations. And then as long as you meet the terms and conditions, you end up on the long list. So it felt like a really lovely thing to have the book listed alongside some really, you know, varied, diverse, great books, and to be there on the Guardian website and to know that, you know, especially because I'm published by a small independent, that there's that chance that someone might come across this. And then in the next stages is where it really gets challenging. So to get in the short list, it depends on multiple readers. So having a bit of a fan base who are willing to nominate you alongside one other title and write a short review. And what was great, I didn't go through in kind of forensic detail and scroll through, but I did have a quick look and there were people who were kind of putting my name forward, which was really lovely to see. But I didn't get the critical mass in that second stage to get to the shortlist. But it was a really positive experience overall. And I think the shortlist has some really interesting titles and quite a few independent publishers on there, and there's some quite exciting things happening with small publishers at the moment in the UK.
So you mentioned your second novel. Would you like to tell us something about what you're currently working on?
So it's just in the early stages. I just actually went on my first ever writing retreat to try and kind of really delve in and start working on it, which was great. The book's set in 1842, so it's a little bit of a new direction for me, because May, I think it does move around in time, but the earliest chapter is in the 1950s, and most of it is quite contemporary. So it's set in 1842 in Preston, and it's in the aftermath of a mill workers' massacre, in which six people died. So it's almost like a mini Peterloo, but it's not as well known. And it's set during a week of carnival that happens soon after that. So it's a real time of chaos and turmoil and things being disrupted. And I don't want to say too much because it's still in the early stages and it could all change. But what I'm trying to explore really is that pull between individual kind of desires and wanting escape and fulfillment personally, but also feeling that you've got this collective responsibility to fight for bigger things and what you do when you pull between those two forces. It's also a little bit about faith and doubt. There's going to be a subplot about Mormons in Preston at that time. There was quite a lot of religious activity, and the first ever Mormon missionaries outside of the US actually came to Preston and were baptizing people in the river. So it's sort of about all these different forces that are happening on the characters and them being pulled in different directions. And I'm a little bit scared about it because it's quite complex, but I'm loving the research. I'm reading newspapers from the time and different sources and really trying to immerse myself in that world. But it really depends. I work full time as well, so it depends on me being able to be disciplined and work on it regularly, I think. But that's what I'm trying to write at the moment.
Well, it sounds like something I'd love to read, because I think somebody needs to write that book about the Preston Chartists, don't they? So that sounds absolutely brilliant. And so I hope you get it finished and let me know when you do, because I'd love to read it. And now I think Nicola's got some questions.
I have, yes. I opened the book and you had me at Nature Boy, quoting musical. I think especially in view of the fact that Alzheimer's is supposed to be really one of those things that music helps, isn't it? When people go into homes and play the music of the time, or if the Alzheimer's sufferer used to be in the music industry or whatever, or be, you know, able to play a piano, is supposed to. So I love the way you quote songs through it. You know, she gets into a loop in her head where especially if the song, the lyrics you're quoting have got like a rhythmic quality to them. How did you have that idea to do that, and how did that all come about?
That really came about from me being in the day centre, because I witnessed it firsthand, and I think it is getting more well known now. And anybody who cares, or you know, has relatives with dementia will witness this if music is kind of part of that environment. But I was sitting with some of the residents, the people who were visiting this day centre. They used to come for respite. So they were tended to be early or mid stages of various forms of dementia. And there was a man who was almost completely non-vocal. He wouldn't talk very much. He would express emotion and he responded to touch, but he didn't answer. He didn't seem to be able to form sentences or express himself through language. And there was an afternoon music session they had a conservatory. And they played a Frank Sinatra song, and he just sang the whole thing word for word. And it was such a surprising thing for me to witness at the time, because I didn't know very much then about the way dementia affects the brain, and how I think they say that the part of the brain that retains music and music lyrics and kind of those kind of, you know, like idioms and repeated, you know, rhymes, things that kind of become deep rooted, doesn't necessarily change at the same rate as other parts of the brain. So there's a scientific explanation, but it didn't feel scientific to witness it. It was really beautiful to witness. It took there was a moment of joy there.
Yeah. It took, I mean, just reading the lyrics and realising I knew the song took me back to a certain moment in time. And then I remembered how I felt. It was the night of when Margaret Thatcher came into power. It was George Benson, Nature Boy. And then I went looking for the lyrics just to check I'd got it right. And then I found Nat King Cole had sung them. So, you know, that whole opening paragraph just gave me a personal experience of that. It was wonderful.
What I wanted to do by having those lyrics, and what I knew was obviously you can't control how readers come to a book. And I knew that by putting that in there, some readers would hear it in their head. They would hear the music. They would know the song and the different versions of it. And the Nat King Cole one was the one I was thinking of. But of course, there are multiple versions. But also, there will be people who don't know the song. But I think now it's so easy to kind of Google something and find it out. And I think those lyrics have a kind of mystery and rhythm, like you say, of their own. There's a kind of poetry there that really tied in with some of the themes of the book and some of the memories. So, yeah, I really wanted to do that. I think it's really interesting to try and do that when you only have language. So there's a lot of focus, I think, about dementia on how it destroys language and the ability to communicate, and it destroys memory. But it's beyond that, I think. It's also perception and embodiment, the way that people with dementia may not be very vocal, may not be able to express themselves, but can still respond to touch, can still remember physical rituals, for example. Mm. So there's quite a challenge in writing a book when all you have is language to put on the page, but you want to kind of go beyond just the tragedy of someone not being able to speak anymore, because it's more than that, I think. So by putting the kind of snatches of, you know, biblical quotes or song lyrics, or she remembers, you know, a Cadbury's Roses advert at one point.
Yes.
I wanted to kind of show how, you know, these snatches of language, of music, of different impressions can come back and take us to different places. And like you say, it happens to all of us, maybe not in such an extreme way, but, you know, a smell can take you somewhere, can't it? Can suddenly take you back or remind you of something. And I wanted to kind of integrate that into her voice, which is quite fragmented, but that it's made up of all these different impressions that can suddenly transport her somewhere, which could be comforting, but sometimes distressing as well.
Yeah. And the other thing I picked up, I'm reading it at the moment, and I haven't got, I'm about a quarter of the way in. The character that you really like, the care assistant lady, is starting to, she's having a conversation with one of the other care assistants, and they're starting to talk about how there's this new therapy of just going along with what they say. I don't know how big a theme that's going to become in the book or not, but I've found it fascinating. So you obviously did some good research about what's common practice now, or what's becoming common practice.
I did try to, and I was really interested in the idea of person-centered care, which is obviously really well established now, this idea that the person should come first, and that it's not just about someone exhibiting symptoms, but, you know, it's considering how they might be affected by their environment, their own personal history, and role in a family or a community. And that's really important. I think that is well known and well established in the care field and in the medical profession now. I'm not an expert by any means, but what I also think is that it's not always fully implemented. Yes. And I think that's to do with funding and training and how much care assistants are paid. And, you know, if you can have some very well-meaning people, very dedicated people who work hard, and it's a hard job, who, you know, if you just don't have the time to sit with someone and talk to them, it's hard, isn't it? You know, the ideal might be there, but whether it gets implemented regularly is another thing. And I think that really, really varies across the care, establishments. So I did want to kind of show that. But yes, I think that idea that we have to consider the individual, and kind of, and sometimes there are places that nod towards that. They might have a little book that outlines a person's history, but how does that really affect the way that they're treated on a regular basis? So I think there are movements, and there's an awareness of that need to be centered around the person, but how much that's really happening and how far it goes, I don't know, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does it make you feel different about Alzheimer's, or doing, you know, getting into the story and then doing the research? And do you feel better about it all now, perhaps, or not?
I do. And it's a strange thing to say, because, you know, that's the other thing I didn't want to do, was write a really idealistic, romanticized version of dementia, because it is a really hard thing. And, you know, it's hard for the person living with it, especially if you're diagnosed. People are diagnosed a lot earlier now. So how do you live with the knowledge of what's going to happen? That's really scary. And I think for carers and for family members, it can be so painful to see somebody that's been a huge part of your life change before your eyes and perhaps not recognize you. That's quite a wound, you know, for your own identity. So I didn't want to efface or avoid the difficulties, but equally I didn't want to reinforce the most negative and reductive stereotypes. And it was a really hard balance. What I would say is, there were really dark moments when I was researching this where I really wished I wasn't writing about it. Just as you said, you know, you pick up a book and think, I'm not sure I want to read a book about dementia. And in the early stages, in the first year of me researching this, I had this really interesting experience where I went to a conference about aging and creativity. And I was listening to someone read a poem about their grandmother having Alzheimer's. And I started crying. And I'm really kind of British about this, and I was quite embarrassed. I didn't want anyone to see that I was upset. And I started thinking about my own grandfather, who, he died of Parkinson's disease. And he died, he was in his early 90s when he died, and I was 16. And he'd lived with me my whole life. He'd lived in our house. So he was this I was the last child at home, and he was this permanent fixture, and I loved him to bits. He had Alzheimer's. He had, a form of dementia associated with Parkinson's toward right at the end of his life. And honestly, I know it sounds ridiculous, but I was already writing the book, but I hadn't connected what I was doing with him because I think I thought I was writing about Alzheimer's. He hadn't had that diagnosis. And I realized that, what I was doing was in some way connected to that. I hadn't dealt with his death very well. I hadn't, in the final stages, even though I was very close to him, I just avoided him. You know, he was in the same house as me. Finally, he did go into a home. I didn't visit him as much as I could have done because I was 16 and I just didn't cope with it. Mm-hmm. I didn't really grieve. And I think in some ways this book was me kind of dealing with that. I didn't realize that's what I was doing, but it was trying to face this darkness. You know, I'd felt so scared that he didn't recognize me anymore. I didn't know how to deal with that or what to do with it. And through researching it, through volunteering, through writing this book, I think I was able to find a little bit of hope that, yes, it's not something anybody wants for themselves or for someone they love, but there has to be more positive ways to cope with it, to live with it, to help people live with it. And I do think there are some promising things going on, like the dementia village that's in, the Netherlands, where they try and set up a really humane, and they try and allow people with Alzheimer's and dementia to feel that they still matter, they still have a place in the world.
Yeah.
I think there are much better ways that we can deal with it and face it, even though it will always be difficult. And I think for me, I stopped being so scared, which was a positive thing, to face. They say that it's better that we face mortality and that we talk about death, even though it's hard. And I think I faced some things that I didn't want to face. And I think that's can only be a healthy thing.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for being so honest. That's really interesting.
Thanks for sharing with us.
That was fascinating.
Wow.
And dedication to the cause as well.
Well, absolutely.
Working
yeah,
at the centre.
And I'm really interested in the second novel that she's working on. Having worked in Preston and walked from the train station to the university every day, passing the monument to the Chartists who fell in the streets there.
Do you know, I worked in Preston and walked from the station, and I don't have any recollection whatsoever of a monument.
Oh, maybe you probably went by Marks and Spencer's and did a bit of shopping on the way down. Yeah.
Well, I've been reading this book, May, about the woman who has dementia, and I do find it very difficult sometimes. I find that I get angry about it when I start to read a book and we go skipping around through time, and not even the background is also skipping around, and so I refuse to accept that. So I just pick out, in this one, the years are listed. So I've been going through the years in order. I don't care how she arranged it. I want to know linearly, how this takes place.
This is really interesting because obviously I'm trying to weave together various strands in my book and in the past and in the future and all that stuff, and I'm not absolutely sure how to do it yet. And I'm like you, I prefer a linear novel, so I'm not quite sure how to do that with mine at all.
Well, why do you have to make it otherwise then? Why are you trying to?
I don't know. We won't talk about that in this bit.
Okay, well. I think it's nearly time to wrap up for this week. But before we do, there's just time for Steph and Sam Blake to tell us what they're reading at the moment. So, Steph, what's on your bedside table?
Right, I am reading The Other Mrs. Walker by Mary Paulson Ellis. It was a book that was recommended to me by somebody that I met online doing reviews of one another's work. And she said, I think you'd like The Other Mrs. Walker, so I got it. It's about an old lady who dies alone. Well, it starts with an old lady dying alone over Christmas in Edinburgh in a flat. And a few days later, this middle-aged woman, Margaret Penny, arrives back in the city and goes to stay with her mother. And Margaret's got something's happened to Margaret. She arrives in a stolen red coat and she's got very little, she's obviously got some sort of problem in her past, and she has to move in with her mother and sleep in the box room on a lilo, and she's obviously having a hard time. So she finds herself a job at the Office for Lost People, and she's assigned to investigate who were the family of this old lady that died on her own.
Mm.
So it's kind of a detective story, but there was no crime.
Mm. Right.
And there's no detective.
Ah.
But it's unravelling. It's quite interesting. Yeah. It's got the elements of a detective
story. Where would one find the Office of Lost People?
I've no idea. It may be a fictional
I was just wondering if
but it's the idea is that somebody's got to pay for the funeral.
Right, yeah. I see.
So yeah. They've got the old lady in the mortuary, or have they? We'll come back to that. Okay. Her job is to go and track the family down.
There are agencies that's what they do.
Mm. They're air hunters,
yes,
aren't they?
Yes, yes.
But that's to try and pass on the money. This is that they're going to track the family down to make them pay for the funeral because she's died penniless.
You wouldn't think that it would be worth their while, really.
Well,
it's great.
It's fiction.
It's a story. It's a conceit. It's a what if.
So, I absolutely love The Office of Lost People.
Sounds like something out of Harry Potter.
Anyway, I'm enjoying it. It's good.
Good. Okay. Thanks for that. Now, over to Sam Blake, who is also going to share what's on her bedside table.
Just finished one that's called When All Is Said, which is coming out in January, which is by a lady called Anne Griffin. And I couldn't recommend that highly enough. That is, I think, possibly the best book I've read, certainly this year, probably in years. She's a brand new author. It's a debut. She did a creative writing MFA, I think. But basically it's about, and it's one of those completely no-brainer ideas. You know, when you read a novel and it's got this amazing idea and you're just like, why didn't I think of that? It's about a farmer. So it's very Irish, but it's beautifully done. It's like every man. So she's managed to capture the whole Irish farming scene just brilliantly. It's about a farmer on the last night of his life, and he goes into a bar and he raises five toasts to people who have influenced his life. So really it feels like a book of five short stories because it's the five toasts relate to different parts of his life. But honestly, I started crying on page 21. I was bawling by page 64 and couldn't even see till about 72. And then the end had me in tears as well. It's absolutely incredible. It's such a simple story. It's so beautifully written. Can highly recommend that. It's called When All Is Said. It's coming out with Hachette in January. And I think it's going to win prizes left, right and centre. Honestly, I think it's like booker material. So it's really just thrilled for her. Thrilled that, when you've been writing like you guys are, you're writing away and you're writing for a long, long time. And then you stumble over something and it's just so perfect. There's nothing you can fault in the book.
Well, that's the end of another Write Club, the podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us again next time. But meanwhile, why not invite a friend to join us to help us grow the podcast? Goodbye.
Bye.